Charles Maxwell on Maui decided we needed to have a wounded knee to show Congress that Hawaiians were not all happy natives playing music, dancing the hula, being beach boys. And it was time that we begin to do something to challenge U.S. control over Hawaii.
Welcome to the Sacred Land Film Project's audio archive, where we revisit the clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we revisit a 2011 interview with Native Hawaiian historian and land protector, Deviana Pomakai McGregor. The fourth episode of our Standing on Sacred Ground series tells the story of the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana and their efforts to return the island of Kaho'olawe to Native Hawaiian sovereignty after 50 years of bombing by the U.S. Navy. Of all the indigenous communities I've been honored to work with, the Native Hawaiians were the most cautious, wisely suspicious of people from the mainland offering to tell their story. The Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana, or PKO, decides everything by consensus, so I had to visit five islands to explain our intentions. This very spirited collective of sacred land defenders had never allowed their story to be told by an outsider. One committed PKO member, the professor and author, Deviana McGregor, was particularly difficult to win over. She needed to make sure I was ready to connect with the island, to listen to what Hawaiians call the voices of Kanaloa Kaho'olawe. Deviana's partner, Dr. Emmett Aluli, advised me to take my family to the island before formally seeking permission to film, the idea being that the island's protectors could best size me up by observing me with my family, how I treated them, how they behaved, how I behaved. After a wonderful trip to the island with my filmmaking partner Jessica and our two young children, and after Deviana understood a little bit more about our approach to telling indigenous stories, she was on board. In 2011, we sat down in her office at the University of Hawaii Manoa to record the story of the decades-long struggle to win back Kaho'olawe. As a historian who studies Hawaii and the Pacific, Deviana framed the story within a much longer timeline and within traditional Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiian practices. We weren't able to include this background in the film, so I'm really glad we can share it now. In this audio archive episode, we discuss the U.S. military occupation of Kaho'olawe and the movement to win back the island. Don't miss part two, where Deviana shares more about the Native Hawaiian cosmology and cultural practices that have been revived through the healing of the island, which, as Davy explains, is also healing the people. But first, we had to confront the past and 50 years of military abuse of a sacred island.
On the day after Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States declared war on Japan, it also declared martial law over all of Hawaii and declared control over the island of Kaho'olawe as a training center for live fire training exercises on the island. And every major U.S. battle in the Pacific was first staged on the island of Kaho'olawe. So Kaho'olawe came very center to the whole World War II campaign of the United States against Japan to reclaim the islands that Japan had controlled across Micronesia. So the island was taken over, and all of this the people of Hawaii supported because we were so fearful of Japan invading Hawaii and taking it over completely. In fact, at Kanapō on Kaho'olawe, it was believed that Japan would come and have submarines based there and from there launch attack on Maui to take over Hawaii. So the island became a center for perfecting submarine warfare. They went to Kaho'olawe on the side where the tall cliffs are, and they would aim at the island and keep firing their torpedoes until it was perfected. And so, you know, you have all these what looks like caves on the other side of the island, which were actually from this torpedo training during the World War II time. So there was a lot of fear about Japan taking over Hawaii throughout the war. And everybody accepted that the military was important to our defense. But we also believed that once the war was over, that our lands would be returned. And we found that our land was never returned. You know, that after World War II, then there's the Korean War. You have Ko'olawe now used for training in how to bomb Korean-style vehicles on the island. And then during the Gulf War, now they put up silkworm missile sites on Ko'olawe to give pilots practicing in how to bomb these kinds of missile sites. And so you have the continuing use of the island rather than it being returned to the people of Hawaii, and really this abuse of an island when land is so precious here to all of us for living, but for Native Hawaiians, it's a very precious resource as a spiritual entity. And so growing up in the 50s and 60s, no one questioned the role of the military in Hawaii.
But then in the 70s, the rising sentiment against the war in Vietnam, along with destruction of burial grounds by tourist hotels and beach closures by private property owners, all combined to spark a movement to challenge the U.S. Navy's use of Kaho'olawe as a bombing target and testing site.
It really took the changes nationally with the anti-war movement questioning the role of the military in Vietnam, the student rights movement questioning the drafting of our young men into the military service, and the civil rights movement, which began to challenge the unequal treatment and denial of rights of minority people, and more particularly the Native American movement, where you have the Wounded Knee occupation and the occupation at Alcatraz Island. And as Hawaiians, we're beginning to observe that you can begin to challenge the military, that maybe what the military is doing is not all just, and that we as Native people have rights to the land and our resources that we didn't realize we had. There's also the movement in Puerto Rico at Vieques to challenge military bombing of their islands. And so all of this is enlightening to us. In Hawaii, there was a movement, an organization called Aloha, which stood for Aboriginal Lands of Hawaiian Ancestry. They actually were being funded by the Alaska Natives, who had gotten their rights recognized through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And they supported some funding to Aloha to then go to Congress and introduce a bill for the United States to acknowledge that it had engaged in an illegal war against Hawaii in 1893 when it landed troops to overthrow the Queen. And because of that, the Hawaiians had suffered poor health, poor social conditions, very awful economic conditions, and that can all be rooted to having the governance of our nation taken away and dissolved and replaced with a provisional government and a republic and then a territorial government and, you know, now a state government, which all can be traced back to the illegal war that the United States conducted against the Queen, Liliuokalani. So this bill was proposed in Congress to acknowledge that injustice and then to make reparations to the Native Hawaiian people for this injustice. And there had been reparations that the United States had just paid to the Japanese who were illegally interned during World War II. And they had made reparations to the Maine Indians for violations of their rights over their lands. And so now we were claiming that the United States owed reparations to the Native Hawaiians. But, you know, the bill went nowhere. And so the leader of Aloha, Charles Maxwell, on Maui Island, decided we needed to have a wounded knee to show Congress that Hawaiians were not all happy natives playing music, dancing the hula, being beach boys, just really happy having tourists and playing music, that life wasn't paradise for the Native Hawaiian people. And how are we going to show that? And he said we needed to have our own wounded knee and occupy federal land. And so he said, you know, maybe Pearl Harbor, maybe Haleakala National Park. But when the day came, the call went out, he said, we're going to occupy Kaho'olawe. And so people showed up from all the islands, got on boats, went out to Kaho'olawe, to occupy it, to demand reparations for Native Hawaiians and justice for Native Hawaiians. And then the Coast Guard showed up and told the fishing boat operators that if they were going to land on Ko'olawe, that their fishing boats would be confiscated. So all the boats turned around at that point, except one boat made it through. And this boat had the men and some of the women, but the men who had come from Molokai, as well as some others from other islands. And they were the first ones to make through and land on the island.
While Deviana wasn't on that boat, she and everyone else in Hawaii have heard the story from the founding members of the PKO, including her life partner, Dr. Emmett Aluli.
Those who landed were arrested except for two men, Walter Riddy and Emmett Aluli, who had managed to go into the backlands and begin to explore the island. So there were three of the men from Molokai, and when the main group was arrested, George Helm, who had been with the group, had previously been taken off by a journalist. And so Walter and Emmett were there on the island for two nights before they were picked up by the military and arrested. And while they were there, they witnessed all of the destruction of the land and the ordnance, the live bombs. They could see the abuse of the island very physically. But they also really felt a very strong spiritual presence in the island, a very strong spiritual entity that began to speak to them. And they didn't quite know how to explain or understand this. And I call it that they had an epiphany on the island, that they had come to the island. It was looking at this island as a military bombing target. But when they left the island, they realized that this was a very special and spiritual place. Like the land on Molokai where they came from, it too was a spiritual Hawaiian place and not just a Navy bombing target. And so Emmett Aluli and George Helm and Walter Riddy began to ask the kupuna on Molokai to share what they knew of the island. And what the kupuna, who were very moved, began to share was how the island was indeed a very sacred place, and that it wasn't always just called Ko'olawe, that at one time it was Kanaloa and Kohe Malamalamo Kanaloa, a place that embodied the god Kanaloa of the ocean. And they traveled to speak with the kupuna on Hana, on Kianai, on Maui, and such as Uncle Harry Mitchell. And Uncle Harry Mitchell had been raised in Honuaula, which is right across the channel from Ko'olawe. And Ko'olawe, in some traditions, is actually an ahupua'a, or a land section of the Honuaula district, or the Moku. And so his family had gone back and forth to Ko'olawe and knew chants which spoke of the island as Kanaloa and its role in navigation training. And Uncle Harry shared what his kupuna told him about the importance of the island spiritually and for training and navigation. And they traveled to Hawaii Island and spoke with Auntie Edith Kanaka'ole, who was the keeper of the Pele chants and traditions. And there are chants which speak of Pele being on the island and the ocean in Hawaii coming forth from her head on there at Ko'olawe. And there are places there where Kamoholi'i, the shark god, who is in the Pele family, has dwelled and lived. And so Auntie Edith Kanaka'ole shared what she knew of the island and its spiritual nature. And she also advised George and Emmett that they shouldn't be organized in a Western manner as an association, that they should be organized as an ohana, as an extended family for the island, and to care for this island as a part of a family and as a member of this broader ohana. So they took all of this and they began a movement to save this island.
It's no surprise that these ohana founders from Molokai, the Hawaiian island with one of the strongest native communities, would turn to their elders, their kapuna, for advice on how to proceed. That advice planted the seeds that led to the creation of the Protect Ko'olawe Ohana.
And it was George's inspiration that the island be a place to reconnect with our practice of aloha aina. And the call was to come and aloha this land, to love and care for this land as an ohana, and to challenge the military use of the island, and that this island should be a pu'uhonua for Hawaiian culture, where we should be engaged as Hawaiians to get back to our roots as Hawaiians and practice aloha aina. The pu'uhonua idea is that in a refuge that you are able to help something be nurtured and it can flourish and it's being in a place that is protected. And aloha aina also means patriotism. After the queen was overthrown, there was an organization that was formed called Hui Aloha Aina. And their call was for the restoration of the queen and to continue to resist the U.S. control over Hawaii and to really oppose an annexation. And Emmett's aunt had been part of this movement, the Hui Aloha Aina Wahine, and he knew of the Aloha Aina newspaper and this whole movement that Aloha Aina means a patriot that loves the land and will fight for the nation to be independent and never to come under the control of the United States. So Aloha Aina also had this idea of anti-military and anti-U.S. control over Hawaii. And as the movement grew, it began to strike a chord because it linked up with this idea of challenging the U.S. role in Vietnam. But the broader call was for Hawaiians to begin to protect our land from the abuse of the military. And as we went out as island, when people went island to island, it really struck a chord with everybody that, yeah, since statehood in 1959, now to 1976, all of this change and development that occurred, who benefited from it? Not the Hawaiian people, not even the local people in Hawaii. All of the profit that was made from tourism was going back to America. And who was it that was being evicted to make way for these developments? Who was it whose fishing grounds were being desecrated, whose cultural sites are being desecrated for this development? It was the Native Hawaiians. And it was time that we begin to do something to challenge U.S. control over Hawaii. And, you know, this had begun with Kalama Valley and it became one of the central organizing initiatives of around Kaho'olawe, that on every island we can come together and see that we should challenge the abuse of this island by the military and challenge U.S. control over Hawaii. Because this island was the land of the Kingdom of Hawaii. It was government land. And the land of the Kingdom of Hawaii was never turned over to the U.S. government by the Hawaiian people or by the Queen herself. It was stolen by the provisional government and then claimed by the Republic. And the Republic used its illegal claim over these lands and turned it over to the U.S. government. And we had to challenge U.S. control over this land, because it is all goes back to this illegal war against the Hawaiian people by invading Hawaii on January 17, 1893. So all of this came together for us. And as the movement grew, the main form in the first year was occupation of the island, continued occupation in the face of the military. And the military, you know, continued to arrest, and people get caught up in these lengthy court battles, and the bombing continued. You know, finally it was when Walter Riddy and Richard Sawyer decided they wanted to occupy the island on a long-term basis with the thought that the Navy would stop while people were on the island. And for a while the Navy did stop. They searched for them and they used all their fancy technology that they were used to heat-seeking to find people that they're using in Vietnam War against these two men from Molokai. And when they couldn't find them, they concluded that this was a hoax and that they were just going to start bombing again, because probably they weren't there because they couldn't find them and their technology couldn't detect them. So they probably weren't there. And then this is when George Helm was asked by their families to go and warn them and bring them off.
George Helm was a popular Hawaiian musician, a charismatic activist, and a born leader. He fell in love with the island as a place where ceremony could be revived, and he put his life on the line to defend and protect it, and to protect the members of the Ohana.
The real spiritual and inspirational leader for the Ohana at the time was George Helm, that he had the vision of Kaholavi becoming this pu'uhonua for the Hawaiian people and the Hawaiian culture. And he was the one who began to look into Lonoi Kamakahiki and envisioning that Lonoi Kamakahiki would be the way for us as Hawaiians to reconnect with Aloha Aina and spiritually to help this island come back to life. George was a very articulate and charismatic leader. He was a beautiful falsetto voice singer who could touch our hearts and souls through his music and then tell the story that linked it all together in a very cultural, meaningful way that was very grounded in his having been raised on Molokai and grassroots origin. And so George really would be very convincing and compelling, and also you knew that he was someone who cared for everyone. You know, he cared for his family here on Molokai. He cared for the Ohana as it was developing. For him, it was a movement as an Ohana, and you had that confidence in him as a leader that he would be taking care of everyone, and that his leadership was based on this true love for the land, love for the people, and a vision of Hawaiians coming together as a people to reclaim what is rightfully ours and to seek the justice that we deserve. So he was very important to the whole movement. And so when the Navy announced that they were going to resume the bombing, the families of Walter and Richard naturally came to George to ask him for help. It wasn't the Ohana strategy to go and occupy Kaholavi for that extended period of time. It was sort of an independent action on the part of those two men. But George felt that even though it wasn't something that was his own and the Ohana's plan, that he needed to come and rescue them at this point. And so he went to Maui to get the resources he'd need to get over to the island and get people who were good watermen to go with him, because he wasn't a particularly good waterman. And the guy who he wanted to have go in had to go take his child in for some emergency care, so he got Uncle Harry Mitchell's son, Kimo Mitchell, to go with him. And they were taken over on the boat, and they never made connection with Walter and Richard. And they had to leave the island. There was a big storm, and they themselves didn't want to get picked up at the time. So the story goes by the third person who was with them, Billy Mitchell, that they had left from Oawawahie on Kaholawe on one surfboard and sought to go to Molokini, where they felt they could get a boat ride back to Maui. But it was an amazing winter storm. It was, you know, gale force winds and huge swells, and really, you know, people didn't really honestly believe that they would have done that, that Kimo knew better. And so, you know, there's other thoughts that they actually, there was a boat that came back to pick them up, and that that boat took them out and did away with them, you know, that there was foul play involved and that they didn't disappear because they had gone out on a surfboard. They disappeared because there were forces that felt George was too powerful, becoming too much of a figure in the Hawaiian movement, that this was also against the interests of the military to have the Ohana be such an important force in the islands, and that it was in the interests of many powers to do away with George, and that they found the opportune moment, that this time afforded, it made him vulnerable. A vulnerable point was provided by this action at this time that he was, that they took advantage of that vulnerable point to do away with him. So we don't really know. We'll never know. Their bodies were never discovered. After 10 years, when somebody's missing, you can have them legally declared dead. We held memorial services for George on Molokai and Kimo on Kanai, Hana and Maui and on Oahu, and then finally a memorial dedication of plaques in their memory on Kaho'olawe itself.
Though the deaths of George Helm and Kimo Mitchell were devastating, the founders of the PKO were committed to a profound long-term vision, and the family structure of the Ohana gave them the strength to carry on.
The loss of George and Kimo was a setback, and it caused the Ohana to reevaluate this strategy and tactic of occupation. George was lost in March of 1977, and the occupations continued through the summer of 1977. But at that point, it was decided that that strategy was too costly and not successful. And so while George was still alive, he had also been the main plaintiff in a civil suit against the military, Aluli versus Brown, but there were a whole list of plaintiffs. And the civil suit was making its way through the court system after George's passing. And by 1980, the court mandated that the Navy has to begin to comply with all the laws that George, when he filed the suit, had claimed they were in violation of. So the Navy was in violation of the Endangered Species Act because there are whales that come to give birth and nurture their young off of the island. And so it was illegal for those ships to be running military exercises while the endangered humpback whales were giving birth and nursing their young there. They were in violation of the Historic Preservation Act because there were thousands of sites on the island and they had never done a survey and there was no plan to protect them. They were in violation of the Environmental Protection Act because they had never done an environmental impact study of the impact of conducting military exercises on the environment and the ecosystem. They were in violation of the executive order which set the land aside because they were supposed to be eradicating the goats on the island and they had done nothing to get rid of any goats that whole time that they controlled the island. And finally, and most importantly for the Ohana, they were in violation of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, which said that the military services have to afford Native Americans, including Native Hawaiians, access to their spiritual lands to conduct our religious practices and to also engage in our cultural practices. So the court found that Navy was in violation of all these laws and mandated that the Navy engage in a consent decree with the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana to begin to address all of these issues. And most importantly, to allow access for the Ohana to the island for this time forward. Signing a consent decree was very controversial for the Ohana because it meant that we would have to have joint use of the island with the military. It wasn't all or nothing. We couldn't just get rid of the military. We could get access to the island, but we'd also still have to live with the military doing exercises on the island. So it was a very painful process, and it resulted in a split, and some of the more activist types left the Ohana at that time. So the Ohana had to make a decision. Was it going to sign the consent decree and have access to the island and begin to care for the island versus a long drawn-out struggle, which you don't know what the result was going to be? Many people who were active in the early stages of the Ohana split from the organization, but those who remained had to move forward and begin to build a relationship with the island. And the consent decree said that the military had to stop bombing for 10 days of every month. And within that 10-day period, they had to begin to look at the cultural sites, survey the cultural sites, take care of them. They had to begin a reforestation program. And most importantly, they had to allow the Ohana access to the island for 4 days within that 10-day period. The military, under the consent decree, was limited to using only the central third of the island for live fire ordnance training. The other two-thirds of the island, within that 10-day period when the bombing stopped, they had to begin to clean up the ordnance from those other two-thirds of the island. So I think there was substantial gains made from the consent decree, but most importantly, it allowed the Ohana to begin to establish this relationship with the island and to bring hundreds and then thousands eventually of others in the islands to connect and reconnect and care for this island and physically care for the island and begin to care in their hearts that this island was important and it was sacred and it was spiritual. And that's what really became the turning point in our movement, because from 1977 until we ultimately were able to stop the bombing in 1992, the Ohana brought thousands of people to the island. We began to rededicate our religious sites. We began to cultivate, revegetate, and bring life back to the island. And this whole movement then became less anti-military and anti-US control over Hawaii, but more a positive assertion as ourselves as Hawaiians, reclaiming our soul as a people through this island, that it gave us the spiritual connection to our ancestors and to our spiritual beliefs. And we were able to call back our gods. In 1980, after signing the consent decree, we began to call back Lono to come and bring life to this island, bring his rains to help the soil get soft and so it will receive our plants and the island can begin to come back to life, to call back to Kanaloa, to come and help us have these negative forces slip away from the island, to have the Navy slip away and eventually honor this island once again as Kanaloa Koho'olawe, to call on Kane to bring the rains as well that come in the season outside of Lono's time and bring those rains to help the land live, to call on Papa, the Earth Mother, to help us to cleanse the land as it's needed in this process of regeneration. So we begin to establish a new relationship with this island and through this island reconnect to these spiritual entities and these life forces that will help us as a people and also the land live again. And Koho'olawe and that whole process was not only important for the life of the land of Koho'olawe either, that as people came from every island and engaged in cultural activities on Koho'olawe, then they took that back to their home island. And soon you had makahiki not only on Koho'olawe, but on Hawaii Island, on Molokai, on Oahu. You know, people were taking the practices that they learned from Koho'olawe, their experience on Koho'olawe, albeit while the Navy was still there, that these experiences began to spread through other islands. And our religious beliefs and practices began to be revived on all the islands, not just but on Koho'olawe, but because Koho'olawe had brought us in a relationship with each other and with our spiritual ancestors to begin as Hawaiians to take these practices to all of our islands.
While Daviana McGregor is now a leader in the Protect Koho'olawe Ohana, it took her some time to build her relationship with the island.
The island being sacred and being special, it's not for everyone to come to the island. And my own personal experience is that I tried 3 different times to go to the island, and I wasn't ready. And the island didn't let me come. You know? And the first time I came, I had all my students. We had studied Koho'olawe, all of its environment. We studied the environmental impact study, and we were going to critique it so that we make sure that everything had been taken into consideration. We critiqued everything that the Navy was saying, and that was our study. And then, you know, spring break, we're going to go and actually touch the land and be inspired. And it was a huge spring storm, March storm, and we never made it. We went instead with Uncle Harry, took pity on us and took us out to Kenai, and we were in the taro patches helping him weed the taro, and you know, we stayed in a church and we waited out the storm there. And I tried two other times and it never able to make it. And then finally in 84, I was able to go for the first time. And it was because Paul Kauhani Lu'uai was one of my students. And the Lu'uai family had gone for generations to the island. They are from Makena, which is also across from Koholabe. And they had, during the ranching period, delivered water regularly to the ranchers over there. And they continued to fish and around the island. So he said he would take us over. And I felt really comfortable with that. And Uncle Harry Mitchell, knowing that I had tried three times, said he would come make sure I made it this time too. So we all went over. And it was a really beautiful experience. But I, you know, being kind of a obsessive compulsive, I had to like make sure my students were okay. So the whole time I was just worried about my students and worried about everything. And then somehow the boat that was going to come to us, pick us up, couldn't come. And the boat that could come couldn't take everybody. So a few of us had to stay behind. And so I stayed behind with a couple of my students. And finally, I had the quiet time I needed. And it was that last day and evening that I think the island really touched me and spoke to me. And, you know, just listening, just a few of us talking stories, where we came from, what we were doing on the island, you know, how the island was affecting us, what was happening to Hawaiians, what do we as Hawaiians need to do, you know, all this sharing among each other, but also just the quiet time on the island, that it really, you know, touched me. And then when we left, I really couldn't get the island out of my mind. And, you know, I had an opportunity to go to Maui for something, and I felt compelled to go to the island, Makena side, so I could see the island, and, you know, and it just kept, to me, feeling like I needed to get more involved and make some commitment to the island as well. And, you know, for me, by then, my daughter was older, and so I had time to be able to go. When I was younger and couldn't really go because I had my child, I couldn't make the time to do that. But when I finally made it, I was in a circumstance where my daughter was now older, I could leave her with my family and go over to the island and give some time to the island and make that commitment. And so I was ready. And as I got more time, I was able to get more involved in the stewardship.
Even though Deviana didn't participate in the initial occupation, she's been the backbone of the ongoing efforts to protect Kaho'olawe, a strategic struggle that has required the unwavering commitment of hundreds of people over five decades, with many years of work, ceremony, and healing still ahead.
A lot of emphasis is put on the first year of occupations as what made the difference in stopping the bombing of the island. And certainly that was the breakthrough, that was the puka for us. But really, it's the hard work from 1977 until the bombing finally stopped on October 22nd, 1990. It was that long period of work, those 13 years, that was hard because it wasn't exciting. It wasn't attractive. It wasn't popular. You know, it seemed like we were in an endless, tedious battle that didn't have the drama that the first year had. And it seemed endless. And I remember people keep asking, well, do you think it's possible? And I'd have to say, well, I think it's possible. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it was possible to stop the bombing, you know? And you know, at times it even got worse because then it wasn't just the United States bombing the island. They would bring over Australia and Japan and New Zealand and Canada and Britain to all engage in these RIMPAC exercises, which culminated in everybody being able to take a shot at the island. So the island was bombarded by all these gunships during the RIMPAC exercises, which occurred every 2 years. It's like, now we have to take on all these other navies, you know? But at the same time, it enabled us to build relationships with indigenous peoples. The Aborigines in Australia and the peace movement in Australia stopped the Australian Navy from participating. The Maoris in Aotearoa and Greenpeace helped us stop the New Zealand from participating. We went to Japan, and the peace movement there helped us to stop Japan from participating in these RIMPAC exercises at Koholabe. So we were very successful in also doing outreach internationally to protect this island. In the end, it was just Canada, the United States, that was bombing the island. And finally, you know, October 22, 1990, we were able to finally stop the bombing. And not through anything really amazing, but over a political campaign to get, you know, a Republican elected to the Senate. By the time that the bombing stopped in 1990, there was pretty much like 75% of the people in Hawaii said the bombing should stop. We had convinced the broader public that this was the right and just thing to do, so that a Republican congressional candidate could convince a Republican president, Bush, George Bush, that this was the miracle that they needed to get this Republican elected in a Democratic state, and that stopping the bombing was so popular that it would get this Republican candidate for Congress elected. That's how popular we had become. And now, 20 years later, there are new challenges. In the lifetime of my students who are now coming in, they didn't know the island of Koholabe had been bombed. And they don't know about the struggle of the Ohana. And so they don't appreciate the years of experience, or they don't appreciate the struggle that it took. So you have to continue to educate as they come in, and continue to do that broad outreach to the general public, because the general public as well doesn't have that kind of memory that we have.
Of the 8 stories we tell in the Standing on Sacred Ground series, I think the saga of Kaho'olawe offers the most hope, because after all the struggle and sacrifice, the island is now a sanctuary for Kanaka Maoli cultural practices. I asked Daviana what she's learned from the struggle and what she feels is the foundation of the PKO's success.
The first thing that came to mind is that you have to commit for generations. You have to have this mindset that it's going to take generations to educate people about the importance of a place, to really understand all of the depth of a place that will enable people to feel and recognize a place as sacred. And especially when a place has been so abused as we have, it's going to take generations to bring it back to life and to heal it. And so healing and education to win that recognition is not always in one lifetime, but several lifetimes to achieve. And that's an important recognition. And so for ourselves, looking at organizing as an ohana was very important. That if we had organized in a Western way with the president, vice president, et cetera, we would not have been successful, because then it's just this kind of structure that has no life. But when we began to organize as an ohana, as our kupuna had instructed us, you know, then you begin to understand that it's a relationship that you have. Our commitment in the Protekalabi ohana is not so much to each other as to the island. We become an ohana to each other because we're all connected to this island in a very spiritual and meaningful, heartfelt way. Every group has to organize in their own tradition, and the methods and strategies of organizing also has to be within their own tradition, because it has to have meaning to the people, and it has to also be recognized by the broader public as a genuinely indigenous way of approaching the care of a sacred place. So for us, if we had just continued to be a militant group that could organize a rally or, you know, an occupation, that wouldn't really have been meaningful. Because what became meaningful is that as an ohana, we began to work the land. We began to go on the island to heal it. We began to plant and to rededicate our sites. We began to actually practice our religion. We were accused at first, for example, that we were using the religion just for political reasons and weren't really believers. But we you know, over the period of time, as we began to learn more from our kupuna and experience for ourselves the spiritual connection, we are believers. You know, we understand and we really believe in the sacredness of this place. And I think the more people that you bring to also experience that sacredness and that spiritual connection, then the more there will be support for the, what you're doing. But it's really important, because we took this ohana approach, that we recognize an ohana has to have layers of generations. Very soon after we had stopped the bombing and we no longer had a clear focal point. You know, what are we doing on the island? Why are we on the island? Then we had to really examine how do we begin to interest new generations of Hawaiians to get engaged with the island. What are those activities that we do to engage them? And, you know, this is where we had to understand how to be good stewards of the land. And stewardship of the land is physically bringing the resources, the monetary resources and the physical resources to do erosion control, to build a check dam, to put in the layers of materials that you need to create conditions to plant, to build water catchments and water tanks to hold the water that's essential for the plants to grow. We had to learn the technology that's involved in stewarding lands and replanting, as well as the spiritual practices that call upon our deities to bring the rains and to raise the water table, to provide that ecology for these plants to succeed. So it's really balancing technology and science as well as indigenous knowledge and indigenous scientific knowledge and the spiritual practices all integrated, and then training a new generation in that practice. We began to have training for our next generation when we recognized, you know, that we were getting old and we needed to pass this on. And one thing that we continue to struggle with is, you know, making the space for them to take on those responsibilities. And when we were engaged in one of our training, I was asking one of our botanists, young botanists, I said, oh, you know, I went to Mauna Loa, and we're driving up the road, and I saw all this whole stand of ohia trees, these old ohia trees that were all just dead and standing. And she said, yeah, the theory is that they had a cohort of trees, and they all grew up together, and they all got old together, but they blocked the canopy, and so the young trees couldn't live, so there were no young trees growing with them, and they all died together, and there were no young trees to replace them. And I said, wow, that's a wonderful metaphor for us as an ohana, you know, that us old folks got to make room and allow the space for the younger generation to come up and take over. And so we've been trying to, you know, do that and you know, engage in that kind of planning and sharing of responsibility, you know, together, so that as we go, the new generation begins to take on the full responsibilities, but there's still the advice and support of the first generation assisting them. And really, what does generational planning and mean, and how do we, you know, begin to do that in a meaningful way for the next generation to feel empowered? At the same time, to respect the wisdom and the years of experience of the older generation.
Daviana and the PKO have continued to reach out to other Indigenous people to learn from them, share stories, and find strength in united struggle. She pointed out the irony and the difficulty of educating the public and protecting sacred sites using the World Wide Web.
You know, on one hand, the ability to kind of see it on the web may be deceptive because you really have to experience nature directly and immerse yourself in that nature and the natural life forms to really appreciate it. So that's one thing I think is important that can't necessarily be conveyed over in the internet or YouTube. But I think it has an important service in sharing our experiences as humans, interfacing with governments, what are strategies we can share to better protect our sacred lands and places. So we have to recognize that our deities are natural deities, and they exist in nature, and you can't call upon them to intercede on your behalf for something you want personally, as sometimes you feel you can do with the Christian God. And they are powerful in their own realm, and we have to respect those realms. But their realm doesn't come into the realm we as humans. We have to deal with social forces, development projects, profit-minded development, government laws and agencies. We can't expect our deities to interface with that. So that's our responsibility as humans. And as Indigenous peoples who have struggled in our own, you know, government systems or state systems, I think we have a lot to learn from each other in ways that we have been successful and maybe not successful. We can learn from our mistakes as well. So I think the internet provides us ways to do that, to network and to form alliances.
And the PKO will need to use those alliances as they face new obstacles.
What we've learned too is that every 20 years or so, there's new challenges, and you can't predict what those new challenges are going to be, but all you can do is prepare the next generation to take it on. We're trying to have Kanaloa Kaho'olawe be elevated as a sacred place for the Native Hawaiian Nation, and we need to get the recognition and support from all the people of Hawaii for this. And it involves understanding why land is sacred, and it involves understanding why Kaho'olawe is Kanaloa and is a sacred place traditionally and in our lifetime. And it involves a commitment to reserve a place like Kanaloa Kaho'olawe to be free from commercialization. So these are hard challenges for us and our future generations, but I think we need to learn from other places and other peoples, other Indigenous peoples as well. How have they succeeded in getting recognition of their places as sacred? How can we draw upon their experience as well in their work to honor places as sacred? And in this time where the United Nations has declared what are the rights of Indigenous people, which includes our right to practice our religion, to perpetuate our places as and honor our places as sacred, how can we draw on that international community to recognize Kanaloa Kaho'olawe as a very important sacred place for ourselves and future generations and for the world to really learn? How can Kaho'olawe be a beacon for understanding how to live in a sustainable way with nature, especially for islands peoples, because islands throughout the world, we have unique endemic species. Because we are islands, we have unique sacred places, and it's very difficult to protect these places with limited resources. And how can we get the international community to acknowledge Indigenous peoples, especially island Indigenous peoples, and to protect and support the perpetuation of our way of life and our beliefs.
I look forward to following the work of Daviana and the PKO as they restore the land and traditional cultural practices on Kaho'olawe. You can listen to more of my interview with Deviana Pomakai McGregor in part two of our conversation, where Devi shares insights into Native Hawaiian spirituality and pre-contact society on the islands. You can find that episode at sacredland.org, along with our full audio archive, as well as films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. You can also find a link to our Islands of Sanctuary documentary, the fourth episode in our Standing on Sacred Ground series, which tells the story of Kaho'olawe. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt Wong and Toby McLeod. Our film interview with Deviana was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producer Jessica Abbey. This episode is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in Lejeune, Ohlone Territory in Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.